A group of trepid adventurers enter a world of magic, only to return 2 years later, beaten and bound to silence. Now adults, they are once more pulled into this 20-sided planet. Only now, the consequences of their actions come knocking. If they want to get out of there alive, they'll have to face their mistakes, or die. We'll be discussing the comic Die by Kieran Gillen. Trigger warnings for this episode include mentions of body horror, specifically of the eye variety. Roll for initiative and join us in the world of Die.
Welcome to In Media Les, a podcast about queer relationships in media. My name is Chloe.
And I'm Val.
And today we are going to be discussing the comic book series Die, written by Kieran Gillen. I think I said that right. And illustrated by Stephanie Hans. This comic book series, which is 20 issues and is finished, it's the number of sides on a 20-sided die, is about...
Wait, what?
Yeah, I know. I know. Surprise, surprise. It's about six teenagers. They sit down to play a tabletop game that one of them, quote unquote, invented, and they disappear, and then they return and never tell anyone what happened. But then in 2018, they get sucked back into that world. I'm not sure where to go from there. There's just a lot of stuff that happens, but it's basically...
They play a D&D campaign.
Yeah, they play a D&D campaign. Their characters are kind of all reinterpretations of like classic D&D RPG characters. For instance, Chuck, who's Val's favorite, who we're going to hear a lot about, I'm sure, is the fool. And he basically is very... roguish, and he basically he's more powerful, he's better at what he does when he's acting impulsively or stupidly.
Yeah, literally whenever he's sincere, he is at his weakest.
Yes. So he basically spends the whole series charging in headlong, getting as drunk as possible, throwing himself at a giant monster. You know, anything he can do that's just the stupidest possible thing in the situation is what he does, which is actually
the smartest possible thing he can do.
Yes, because that's when he's safest.
Which
of
makes
course,
amazing arguments for characters I play in D&D.
Yes, it does. Chuck is a very Val character. That's all I'm going to say. I mean, it's not all I'm going to say. We're going to talk about Chuck probably some more.
It's over.
Yeah, the podcast is over. We have talked about Die. We are now dead. Oh, that was bad. Some of the other characters are really interesting. There's my favorite, Ash, who is the dictator, who is a bard who can command people to do things. She is played by Dominic, who is a guy in the real world. Towards the end... So, spoilers. Towards the end, we find out that Dominic is some kind of gender fluid, I guess was the label that was closest, but he acknowledges that that label isn't perfect either. So, some sort of gender non-binary. Ash is my favorite. She rules. She's awful. She's like...
Well, I don't know about awful, but...
Well, she's very cutthroat. She's very like...
Yeah, she's very driven by want and deep personal attachments, and she's selfish, I would say.
Yes.
But it doesn't have to be bad.
She's very goal-oriented, and that's like a euphemistic way of saying, like, she sets out to do something and she's going to do it and doesn't care about the consequences, really.
Yeah.
And... it's interesting because they're in this game world, and multiple times they say like, oh, we've got to treat it like it's real because we don't know if it's real or not. But I feel like Ash is the one who the most seems to get the most kind of sociopathic in this world and treats it kind of like a game.
Well, because at the end of the day, it is.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's real in the sense that the stakes for them are real, but in all the other ways, it is literally a game, and there are parts of it over and over and over again that prove it to us. For example, Chuck's two buddies, the dwarves, it was like Delight and Dower.
Delighted and Dower.
Yes, and they're literally such flat characters that it interferes with how they behave in a way where they legitimately act on that. They say, I wish I could behave differently, but this is the only mode I have. And the NPCs behave like NPCs would, right? So
yeah,
at all times, we're aware that it is a game because everything is programmed to be a very specific way.
Or written, I believe is the word they use, yeah.
So it's like Ash is right because it isn't real. If we use the definition that, like, reality is for humans.
Which is very, but it is real. Like, that's
it
what
is,
we
come,
yeah. Because Angela loses her arm and Saul.
Yeah, Saul, because Solomon.
Saul, you know, loses his eye. So, like, they leave pieces of themselves there when they come back from it. So
yes,
it is
the
real.
The consequences for their actions are very real. But yes. I'm saying for the people living in that world, reality is slightly different than it is to the players, right?
Yes, yeah, that's true.
So once again, like those two examples are the characters suffering, the real players having to deal with actions that they've committed. It's not like an NPC from the world losing
What's
their
an stuff. NPC right? from the world, define that.
Well, this comic. This is the conversation it starts.
Yeah.
I guess everyone other than the six players that came to that world.
But we know some of them are more fleshed out than others. Like Zamorna, is that how you say it?
I think so. But Zamorna. Once again, he's still flat. He's still a person that a young woman of teenage years would lust after, who would corrupt her in some ways, right?
Okay, what about Ash's son? Is Ash's son real or not?
I don't think so, because once again, he has that one... Well, that's just my opinion, right? But he has that one dial. He's the brave, fair, just hero with a very dark past regarding his parents. But he never really exemplifies any other qualities.
Okay, and then that's... So to describe stuff for people who haven't read it, there's also kind of the master. So the world is divided into the 20 phases of a die. The world is a die, and it's implied, I think, that there's different, like there's a master for each side or each face of the die, and like the master for one of them is Jero Token. So is that an NPC Jero Token, or is that a real JRR token?
Well, the way I interpreted it is that's like the idea behind that face of Dai, right? So they're kind of there, but they don't really interact with the world. They just give it its essence. We kind of had the example of Wells being the most interactive, but it also makes sense because in his writing... So I haven't read much of his stuff, but the way he performed, for example, The War of Worlds, right? It was a radio play that caused the panic because people thought it was real.
Yes.
So I think, at least the way I interpreted it, was that's why he's more involved. He's making it more real and becoming a greater part of the story as a narrator, as opposed to the other masters who just kind of create the world and don't put a lot of themselves within it. But that's just how I saw it.
Okay. So what about, I'm keep what abouting you, but I'm just like trying to imagine your theory here. Because then they meet H.P. Lovecraft, who has had dreams of the real world. There seems to be some leakage between the real world, H.P. Lovecraft, and the Die world, H.P. Lovecraft. So how do you square that, I suppose?
Well, once again, it's that thing that each master had a very kind of specific way they interacted with the world, right? And a lot of Lovecraftian stuff is the seepage between planes and these monsters kind of coming through into the real world, right?
Right, right.
So it's also fairly reflective of his writing style or storytelling and such. Same can be kind of said for Charlotte Bronte, who's also in it.
Yes.
And her world has so very little of her in it because she wrote things that were full of romance and kind of propriety, that sort of stuff, right? So she was pretty much just someone who oversaw the realm but didn't interact with it. She just wanted to see it, right? She was an observer, which is ironic because her eyes were constantly covered. I don't know. That's just kind of like how I saw it.
Yeah, the eyes are covered. There's really a theme of blindness among the masters.
Yeah. I like it.
Interesting. Yes.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I've been kind of monopolizing this conversation.
No, it's good because I will start monopolizing it if not.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm actually not a huge fan of using real life figures and events in storytelling. It always takes me out to a level that I'm not comfortable with in storytelling.
You can't suspend that disbelief when there's someone real in like a fictional world. Is that what it is? Or
it's not really that. It's more of the just like a personal kind of, not even a pet peeve, but just something that bothers me slightly. It's like these were real people and we're making them into kind of like this fictional tool to tell a fun story. I don't know. I'm just weird about that. Okay. And then COVID came into play.
Yeah, I feel like this is the first thing I've ever, like the first thing I've ever read or seen that acknowledged the existence of COVID, which is interesting.
Yeah, that definitely made me feel so uncomfortable, but I think it's just like that moment of queasiness that we're all probably going to get right now, especially with it being a reality.
Yes, I really like that part because it shows that the world that they've come back to is very different because their whole thing is like, we need to get back to our world. And they come back and it's not their world anymore. There's this weird other world that looks like their world, but everyone's wearing a mask and, you know, people are asking them about social distancing and it's like everything's different, even though it's the same world. And you know, it's that classic, like, I don't know, it feels like very like Planet of the Apes. It was Earth all along, you know, like, but kind of turned on its head a little bit. And I really liked it. I thought it was a really neat thing to include that, like, they come back and, oh, it's COVID times.
I get it. I understand. But once again, it just felt like it's too early for that. Not that I, like, mind too much. People can write whatever stories they want, and the story is not bad by any means, right?
Okay.
The writers didn't do anything atrocious. It's a really fun and good story, and it's well written. And there are a lot of cool little tricks that the writers did. But
the writer.
Writer. I keep including artists in comic book writing for some reason. I think because, like, it's all writing and art.
Yes.
And I, like, art is, at the very least, 50% of it, right?
The creators, the art, I should say. Is really important, yes.
The creators kind of using these things, to me personally, is weird. But unbiased view of it is, this is a great story. It's really, really good. And, like, the little things really make it fun. When you introduced this to me, I remember you said something like, I hope you're ready for all the meta. And I don't think I was, but I really enjoyed it. I liked being surprised by certain things. But I also really enjoyed all the tropes.
It's definitely a comment on tropes too at times, mm-hmm. which is really interesting. I mean, it's like, and Kieran Gillen has done this in his other works, where it's like a comment on the kind of formalism of role playing and what are the implicit or even explicit rules. For instance, a big theme in Die is like splitting the party, because that's something you're not supposed to do in D&D. Like people mm-hmm. always say, you know, don't split the party. And then like they spend a lot of time split. And when it happens, it's usually because something really bad is happening to at least half of them, or you know, they're in conflict. And there's other elements of it. For instance, the die itself, you know, the grandmaster has the 20-sided die because the dungeon master or game master, you know, is the one who traditionally in D&D, you know, like in original D&D, all the dice were rolled by the dungeon master. The dungeon master figured out if it was a success or not by rolling the dice. Not every player had dice. I think that was very early on and didn't last for very long, but that's how it used to work. And so the fact that the die belongs to the grandmaster, the game master, makes sense. And so he's playing with all these tropes, all these ideas from the real world, and kind of giving them like this fantasy equivalent. And it's really interesting. It's also, I think, incredibly sad, because you mentioned dour and delighted. And so the idea mm-hmm. is that they are two characters that are written that are just one note, one dimensional. They're dwarves. Dour is always sad. Delighted is always happy. And dour dies. And mm-hmm. delighted at that point is like crying and smiling. And he's like, I'm not written to be sad.
Yeah.
So he can't be sad about the fact that, you know, his partner just died. And it's so tragic when you think about it. And you think about all the one-note characters that you've experienced over time and about how they would deal in those situations. It's hard. And that's what I love about this. It makes you think about, like, the characters I've put in my role-playing games and about, like, what would happen to them in this situation. And it makes me imagine a lot. And that's what I love about it. And then, I don't know. I feel like I'm just rambling at this point, mm-hmm. but like, I wanted to address the thing you said you didn't really like having those real world people there, but I loved it. I thought having J.R.R. Tolkien, who appears in like a World War I context, like
yeah.
they're in the trenches. The idea is that like
with hobbits fighting the war.
Yeah. Fantasy England is fighting fantasy Germany. And so fantasy England has like hobbits and it's mostly hobbits. There's a few yeah. elves. And then the fantasy Germany, which is that they're like mechanized dragons. And what is it called? It's called something Prussia. I forget what the name of their
Eternal Prussia.
And yeah. there's that part. And again, this is really sad, where
a group of four hobbits are stuck in the trenches. And then there's yeah. that one guy, right?
Yeah. They're like stuck. One of them's lost his eyes. He wants
the other three are dead.
The other ones are dead. Yeah, and he wants to write a letter home. And he does, and then J.R.R. Tolkien summons the eagles. You know, and it's such a funny thing because it's like that classic thing of like, why didn't the eagles just fly them to Mount Doom from Lord of the Rings, right? And so mm-hmm. it's like a play on that, but then. You see why, because the eagle gets shot down by the enemy.
No, it got shot down by their own wizard.
No, it was by the enemy.
No, it was their own wizard. And then as soon as the wizard shot them down, he sent in four more hobbits.
Are you sure about that? I'm checking right now.
Yeah, look it up. But that's like the ironic part is that their own leader killed the eagle. That was their messenger. It's like when Gandalf sends the hobbits on this adventure, he's practically kind of sending them into the trenches, right? And I kind of like that joke a lot, but also it was incredibly sad because that letter never reaches his family, and that hobbit explained that it's a cycle, and his grandparents his father, all of, like, his previous male relatives from whom the next generation comes have all died in this war. Probably the same way, and it's always four hobbits getting sent in.
Yeah. It's tough to say. They do look similar. It's like the same uniforms. It's impossible to say.
But they're not fighting themselves, right?
No, it's Little England versus Eternal Prussia.
So you would assume that...
they would have different uniforms.
I mean, like, because there's still the four hobbits getting sent in. It should be the same side, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right, you're right. I was
That's what I wanted to hear, Chloe.
Okay.
That I'm right.
But the point is, I think the point I wanted to get to is that, like, then at the end, the hobbits that are being sent over, the commander says, you can simply walk there. And again, another just heart-wrenching thing, because there's that whole thing in Lord of the Rings, like, one does not simply walk to Mordor.
There's a lot of kind of, like, bad jokes in this, too.
Well, I mean, that's...
when they said that, I
have you
I
ever read any Kieran Gillen? Any of his other works?
No.
Not even The Wicked plus The Divine?
No, I really want to. I just have not had the time to get around to it.
Or his Young Avengers run. Oh, he's done some excellent stuff that we need to cover on the show. Because one thing he does do, well, with the Young Avengers, you know, he came into there and I think is kind of just like a thing to like push Marvel to have more representation, made every single young Avenger LGBT.
Yeah, I see a lot of mentions of that comic.
Yeah.
I just have not personally read it.
There's a reason why it's big on Tumblr, and that's why. And then Wicked plus The Divine is very queer as well. Yeah, I mean, a very common trope, I think, in his work is this... is like, or not even trope, but just like thing that he does is like kind of these meta commentary jokes, kind of almost like, I don't know what to call them, like dad jokes or like puns that aren't plays on words, but are plays on like genre tropes or plays on older works. I don't know what you would call that. I guess it's a reference or an allusion, yeah. But like
it's
done in a
pun.
Humorous way. Yeah, it's like, what do you call a pun on a reference? I don't know.
It's a play on words. Just the play happens to be the situation that people are in. This story has a lot of sad parts.
Yes.
But even its structure, though, if you think about it, it is exactly what a tabletop RPG kind of resembles for most RPGs, right? The heroes do get to accomplish the thing they set out to do.
Yep.
It's just in this comic we happen to get, like, the smaller, more minute picture of what happens to the commoner, quote-unquote,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But overall, their adventure was very successful. Like, I can't think of a single time that they actually failed.
Oh, I'm trying to think. I mean, they failed to stop Eternal Prussia from creating the die in Glasstown.
But that created narrative tension.
Yeah.
Which led them to have more RP moments.
Okay.
Right? It feels like something that a DM would do if they're just kind of like, when they're making their way through everything that is planned out with no problem. And no one is talking about any of their emotions, which for like the first 18 issues is the problem here. No one wants to talk.
Right.
And that was the issue in the first trip they took there, which was 2 years they were gone, I believe.
Yes.
And back then, Ash/Dominic narrates that like they had no words to express what they went through. And for the next however many decades they were back in the real world, they didn't talk about it. And then they went back and they still didn't talk about it. Not until after the dice were created and until they had to, like, literally face the consequences and actually talk it out. Because that's the penultimate scene, right? That's, like, the resolution to the whole comic. They each came clean about their feelings.
Yeah, I mean, I think... the whole point of die is that they need to realize what their own point of die is, like, to them. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens at the end. And it's a very beautiful moment. And I don't know, I feel like on the one hand, the ending is, I think, on the surface level, it could be very disappointing to some people who read it. Like, I think at first I had to think about it because, you know, there's no big twist. Everything gets kind of tied up and it's just kind of like, okay, well, at the end, we realized, you know, like, the point of Die was to teach us something about ourselves or to get us to open up about ourselves and be honest about who we are and what we, you know, feel. And even like Ash admits, like, you know, like, I'm still ashamed of how I see myself, you know, like my gender identity, but I'm not ashamed of being ashamed.
Yeah.
And so, like, none of the characters necessarily leave at the end and are perfect, you know, like, it's not like the world is saved and everything is good now. Ash still has gender issues, still gender fluid and struggling with how to express that. Chuck is dead. Matt's dad is still dying. Matt, we haven't even mentioned, who's the grief knight. His dad is still dying.
But alive.
But is alive at the end. Angela is still, you know, kind of like a deadbeat mother going through a divorce because she left her husband for a woman she worked with, and then that fell through, and now she's coming back to see her kids, and I don't know, they're estranged. Isabel, who's a school teacher, got laid off, lost her house. Mm-hmm. And then Saul is blind and has had no life for 20 years. And, you know, there's no happy ending for them. It's
but
just,
there is, in a sense.
I mean,
right?
There are upside. Like, I say this, but then there are glimmers of good things. But, like, on the whole,
they all kind of got the ending they wanted from the game.
Right. Chuck stays and die and become, well, he dies, but he becomes a fallen, basically like a intelligent zombie.
And continues to exist just as he always had.
Yeah, and he gets to stay and die forever.
And live out his glory and just be impulsive and have fun, which I loved.
Yeah.
I love that little guy.
Yeah, so, and then Ash, his wife is pregnant when we get back, or at least maybe they're adopting. They've got a nursery.
They have a nursery, yes. So, it's
so maybe adopting or something. You know, Matt's father's alive. Angela does realize she needs to reconnect with her kids. And Isabel has... she's the hardest
Isabel
one, I think,
is,
to
yeah.
find the upside for, because she's got a tough situation going on. And then Saul's mom, he's reconnected with his family. So.
Yeah. I feel like for Izzy, what I got out of it, and I had very little time to think about it because I finished literally like seconds before we started recording.
Technically after.
A
little secret for you, dear listener.
Only you guys.
Yeah.
I feel like she was very unhappy with her life.
Yeah. And I mean, she's one of the ones with Chuck who initially, they're all about to leave, and she's one of the ones who agrees to stay with Chuck, and that's why they can't get back initially.
Yeah, and like, I feel like even though a lot of bad stuff happened to her, she now has no responsibilities that she's tied to, and the optimist in me kind of sees that as she can choose what she wants to do now.
Yeah.
But once again, like, yeah, that's kind of the ending we got. It's fairly optimistic for the story that was told.
Yes. I mean, to be honest, I thought it was going to end with them kind of stuck and die. Because I thought they were going to realize, like, if I go back, that is going to create kind of the intersection of the die world with the real world. And we don't want to do that. So we're going to stay here.
I thought they were going to bring it back into the world. I thought they were going to be the ones who caused the dies to actually make it there.
Yeah. So to explain, because we haven't really explained this, one thing that starts happening is they realize that, like, the die world is, like, crafting dice. And we don't quite know what they're for, but we know that they want to send them to the real world. And the idea that the fear is that they're doing this so that they can merge the world of die with the real world. Although we kind of, at the end, you know, we realize that the dice that are created are just created to send to Saul so to complete the loop. So it's basically, the whole story ends up being like a big time loop too, which we haven't even mentioned the like time travel element. And I don't know if we can get into that because we would spend like, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, we can try and explain it, but you need like a diagram to understand how the whole time element factors
in. Yeah, it's like a backwards time loop with weird twists in it. I don't think I fully understand it.
And I don't think it's,
think about it.
I don't think you have to fully understand it. Because the whole point is just like the world of Die has kind of existed for a long time, but also it's brand new.
Yeah. And it kind of feels like the mind of a 17-year-old, a 16-year-old creating a world.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like because Saul created it, but he built it on everything that came before. It's just like when I'm running a D&D game for my coworker's daughter and some of her friends, I'm setting in a completely, you know, new world that I came up with. But also everything in it is stolen from other things because that's what you do. So like the world simultaneously didn't exist until I created it. And then also it's just made up of things from other games. So, and that's the world of Die pretty much.
It's a big part of it.
Yeah. So
the narrative itself as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm way too lazy to come up with my own narrative. Why make up my own emotional arc and have to, like, think through all that when I can just steal someone else's?
Amen.
Yeah.
Question.
Yes.
What did you think of Ash and Saul and the vampire guy and Izzy and all of that mess? Because I loved it.
Yeah, I did. Okay, so yeah, there's kind of a love rectangle, square, something like that. I mean, Saul is clearly in love with Ash in some way.
Yes, they're both kind of.
Yeah,
they both and have Ash, a very deep relationship. Yes. Whether that's romantic or platonic is never really explained, but Solomon would do anything for Dominic.
And in fact,
create this world.
Yeah, he created the world because he could tell that Ash was not comfortable in the real world. Like, he says he created this world for Ash.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something, just very, like, intimate about this. Like, I made this world for you. Ash has a child when they're originally there, when they're 16, with Zamorna. I feel like I keep saying it. The vampire.
I think that's correct.
The vampire. But Izzy.
He's like the adult, older man.
Yes.
Created
the
by
Edward the Edward Cullen of the Die series.
But that guy was like a teenager vampire. This dude is like an adult man vampire.
Yeah, he is. Zamorna is a zaddy. I don't know.
Oh, Chloe.
Was that bad?
Let's move on.
That one was a good one. You have to give me credit for that. That was good.
A baddie, because he's a vampire.
Oh, but his name starts with Z. But so, like, when they were 16, Isabel was courting the vampire, and then Ash slept with them and had his child. And so there's some very... This is where, like, the queer elements come into play. Angela is also, who's Ash's sister, who we haven't talked about too much, is bisexual as well. Mm-hmm. So Ash is... probably bisexual. I mean, she has a wife in the real world, or I guess
who she loves.
Yes, and, like that's legitimate.
Their
and real.
Life together is good and solid.
But then in the Die world, she takes multiple lovers, and they're men. So
yes, but also I appreciate that she stays. She doesn't break her commitment to her wife.
Yeah, she's
the
very
second
chaste
time around. Yes.
The second time, yes. Despite marrying the vampire. They do.
Well, that was for political reasons.
Yes, it's a political marriage. So there's no evidence that they consummated in any real way.
Oh, they definitely did not. She was adamant that it's like, no, I have a spouse in the real world. And also, the vampire was under her command, and she would not consider anything he wanted to do as consensual because she was controlling him.
Yes. Although I do find it interesting that, like, her go-to, like, command as the dictator, her role, like, she constantly commands people to love her, and that's, mm-hmm. That's, like, her go-to.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. I don't know what that says about her, whether she has, like... This, whether it's like she has a need to be loved, like, or like a streak of like polyamory, I don't know. But it is very fascinating that that's like, you know, it makes sense with the vampire because she needs to marry him for the political marriage. But there's the, I think he's the Grand Chamberlain of Glasstown, uh-huh. whom she ensnares. And she could
there's
do
also,
any, yeah.
There's also one of the other dictators that tried to stop her from freeing her people.
Yeah.
And she killed her by saying, I think she told her to love her.
Yeah, without limit.
Without limit. And that's her so go-to. Much love literally burned her up from the inside and she exploded or something.
Yeah.
It was violent.
Yeah. And then there's a part where Ash confronts herself, like kind of like the monstrous version of herself. And that version also uses love me without limit.
Very 6 Million Demon-esque scene.
Yes. Uses it on Matt, actually, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah. That was rude.
Yeah.
Okay, I really, really like how her powers get very limited with, like, their travel. Yeah. Because in the beginning, when Saul was still against them... He ensured that she couldn't use the powers during the day, so she could only use it at night, which I think kept through the whole thing, no?
I
don't think we ever see her.
It's only in Glasstown, though.
Hmm.
Because she uses her voice on the boat and underground and stuff. I guess we don't know what time of day it is.
Right. But regardless, there is a harder rule... where the limitation is she only can control one command at a time, even if it's to multiple people.
She can do multiple if they're willing.
Huh.
But
I missed that. Oh, no, she did say something about that, but I don't think I processed it fully.
So at the beginning, one of her ex-lovers approaches a knight who died and his eyes rotted out, and she had used a voice on him to like say something like,
"You won't rest until you next see me," or something along those lines, which is cruel.
Well, he was willing. He asked her to do it and was willing. And she says something like she can do, you know, like four different commands to people who are willing, but she can't. She can only do one command to someone who's unwilling. So, that's where that comes up.
Which, once again, I really like the writing because that is absolutely something that a 16-year-old would think was a romantic, fun idea.
Yeah.
And then we see the reality of it is that person literally did not rest for like 20 years they were away.
Yeah, they became a zombie and basically just...
They died within the year or three years or something like that.
And I suppose that's like a common theme here is that like they're dealing with a lot of the consequences of their teenage years and of a lot of the mistakes they made. Some of them are. Chuck kind of... still lives in that moment.
Which works for him because, I don't know. I feel like he was always the character who ended up being right in every situation. But also that's his power, right?
Yeah.
Him just kind of doing things he wants to do always works out for him.
Yeah.
As long as there's no plan or any sincerity in his actions. And is just him having fun. Which is who he is. And I think out of all of them, he was the most himself throughout the entire story.
Yes.
Which I think is why he was fine dying in that world. Because he had nothing to make up for. He had nothing that he wanted to change in his life. He wasn't like, oh, I wish I was a better dad, or stop marrying over and over again and kind of using people. No, he absolutely loved having that life. He had a great time. And he lived his truth and kept doing that throughout the entire story. And it worked for him. And even in the end, when he did sacrifice himself and die and, like, you know, become the hero, he still ended up coming back to life and outsmarting death.
Yeah. Which is very him.
And not only outsmarting death, but outsmarting death for the dog.
Yeah, Angela's dog, whom she loves dearly, he comes up with an idea that basically seems to imply that the dog will be alive forever. Because he can just keep refreshing it, even though it hurts himself.
He becomes a fallen, which are zombie-like creatures who, like, if you kill them, they come back. And each of them have, like, a spark of life called, what was it called? Like, something gold?
Fae gold.
And the dog disappears unless it gets one of those golden nuggets daily.
Yep.
And he basically kills himself. The dog feeds on the gold he creates from dying. And then he comes back because he's a fallen and they always come back. Which, what a guy.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question actually about him.
Yes.
So when I started reading it, you were like, you're either going to love Chuck or you're going to hate him because he's kind of like misogynistic. But I didn't see that. What made you say that he's a misogynist?
Maybe not so much that he's misogynistic. I guess kind of what I meant more is that, like, definitely in the real world, he treated women as, like, kind of disposable objects. There's that story he tells Delighted about how, like, he went out for dinner and then just saw his wife and saw the other women around and just decided to leave her right then and there. And then, you know, he's been married like 3 times and his third wife is like much younger than he is. And there's other moments where he just seems to, like, And then Angela, he dated Angela for a while, apparently.
And then cheated on her.
Cheated on her. And he says something like to her, like, was I that bad of a boyfriend? And Angela goes, like, yeah, you were. And then he actually says, yeah, I was. So he is at least self-aware of kind of how he is in relationships. So I will give him that. The other thing I will give him is that, like, it would be very easy for Chuck to be like, I don't know, kind of some kind of phobic towards Ash.
Mm-hmm.
And he does push her a bit. There's that scene where they're drinking in Glasstown where he's just kind of like, you know, what's your deal? Why are you a guy in a real world and a woman in this world who sleeps with men?
Mm-hmm.
But he never quite, like, he definitely, like, makes her uncomfortable about it, but he never quite passes into, like, being, like, homophobic or bigoted about it. And he kind of walks a very fine line there, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Well, because, like, he makes everyone around him equally uncomfortable when he does his jokes.
Yeah.
He constantly jokes about Angela's dead daughter.
Yeah.
Which she's not dead in real life, but in this world, she is one of those undead creatures.
It's time stuff. Don't ask.
He's constantly making fun of Izzy and her gods. Yep. Like, no one gets left out. And the thing with Chuck that actually interests me the most is that he has, like, no interactions with any other guys in the story. In a way, I think that's what made him so likable to me. Like, he's not treating all the dudes as full people and then sexualizing all the women. No, he actually is very, I don't want to say antisocial, but he's very bad at it in a way that he's actually a master of. Like, he shoots his shot. If he gets rejected by people in any way, he's fine with it because he's always going to have the opportunity to get something from someone who comes along next. And it's, I think, for everyone, not just like sleeping with women.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a good point that Chuck, yeah, he's so carefree. That allows him, I guess, on a certain level, like he doesn't need to be bigoted or awful, because as long as he acts like he's unafraid, he doesn't have to be afraid. And therefore, mm-hmm. you know, like bigotry in some capacities driven by fear, but he doesn't, if he was afraid, he would actually be weaker. So he can't be afraid.
And not only that makes sense. But yes, absolutely.
Okay.
But not only that, but a lot of the decisions that he makes actually seem so thought out, or at least not thought out, but very deliberate.
Yes.
So he's not a careless person. He's extremely deliberate.
He's not careless, but he is carefree. That's how I put
yes.
it.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember when Izzy teleported him and all the people of the Glass City into the desert by accident?
Yep.
And they were all like starving and out of food or whatever? He got them food.
Yes. He finds solutions.
Yeah. And not selfish solutions, because he seems like a very, very selfish person.
Well, what he does for Delighted at the end mm-hmm. is just such a beautiful moment. So it's a kindness
that no one expects of him, that he constantly does for others without even them realizing.
Yes.
Sorry, I interrupted
no,
you.
No. I was just going to tell this. I was going to show, not tell. Like the scene is like they're kind of approaching the end. They're about to descend into this labyrinth in this Lovecraftian island, and Chuck realizes, you know, like that's not a place to bring Delighted. So he gets Delighted drunk until he passes out, and then leaves him there so that the Delighted doesn't feel obligated to follow them down into the dungeon. And he tells this very beautiful story to Delighted while they're drinking, and then leaves him. And it's, I don't know, it's a very beautiful scene. And I feel like that scene makes Chuck as a character. I mean, like there's a lot of other scenes where Chuck is great, but that scene is just like, this is beautiful. And I really like this guy.
After that scene, I realized that he's been doing it all along.
Yes.
But prior to that, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. All the moments where you think he was just being reckless and not caring and just like treating this like it's a game and that he's just here to goof and drink and have a good time, you realize, no, he was doing this the way he was because this is, you're like, this was intentional because he cares about people. He's again, it reminds me of like, have you ever been like surfing?
No, I've been snowboarding. Is that
maybe
comparable?
Like, but the idea is that like, you know, you think of like the stereotypical surfer as this like laid back, chill dude, no cares in the world. And I went and took a surfing lesson once, and like, it is so hard and there's so much to it and it's very difficult and you have to do so many things and there's so much to worry about. There's just this secret depth to it. And you realize that people who can surf actually have cultivated this skill that's much more work than you think. And that's like what happens to Chuck. You realize like, oh, this was a whole thing. Like carefreeness was... it was not effortless. It was something that required a lot of work on his part and a lot of thought and a lot of care.
And I think he's one of the only characters who never leaves behind chaos. Is he messed up?
A lot
of them make decisions that ruin things for big chunks of the world.
Yeah.
I think he's the only one who hasn't really done that. Because he didn't participate in most things that they were doing that was destructive.
That's true. Yeah. He goes along with some of their plans, but he never initiates them.
Yeah. He never initiates the bad plans.
Yeah.
And whatever actions he takes don't leave behind any casualties.
Well, most of the time.
Well, the only one I can think of is Dower, and that's because Dower sacrificed himself for Chuck.
Yeah.
Which, once again, like, out of all the characters to sacrifice yourself for, Chuck would probably not be the highest on that list because of how carefree he is and, you know, he's always drinking and such. So you would assume that he wouldn't be the first character to sacrifice yourself for. But
that's true.
He's the only one that people really sacrifice themselves for, too.
Yeah, that's true. It's funny. Like, I came into this. You know, I really like Chuck. I knew you were unlike him from the start, but I feel like I'm learning things, too, about Chuck from this conversation.
I think I liked Izzy and Matt the least.
Really? Because I was hoping we could switch to talking about, well, like, we should probably talk about Matt first, but then Ash and Izzy's relationship, because I think that's a really core part that we haven't mentioned. But Matt, mm-hmm. to me, is the most one-dimensional of the player characters. Like, his whole thing is that he plays the Grief Knight, and he's like a paladin who's powered by the emotion of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a sword that talks to him and kind of reinforces that. And his whole thing is that he watched his mom die from like a one in a million, like, anesthesia.
A mistake from a simple procedure.
Yeah. It wasn't even a mistake.
It was just a thing that
random
happened.
Chance. You know, like, whenever you go under anesthesia, there's that small chance. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to his mom. And we do learn that his daughter, you know, had to go through some kind of surgery, and he was terrified, and then his dad is dying. So really,
but his daughter was fine. Yeah.
Yeah. And his dad ends up being alive. So, like, yeah, his whole story feels very, like, I don't know. It just doesn't feel as in depth as the other ones, which mm-hmm. is fine. And Angela is similar. We haven't talked about her much. Like, yeah. Her whole thing is she loves her daughter, and, like, she realizes that because she was working so hard, maybe she wasn't there as much for her daughter. So, like, Matt and Angela, to me, are kind of the most one-dimensional characters, but they're fine. I don't know if you have anything to add.
I think Matt, Izzy, and maybe Angela. But no, I think Angela's changed. I think Matt and Izzy are the only characters whose bio on the first pages of every issue does not change. Because from time to time, they do get altered slightly.
Yeah, I'm looking. Yeah, Izzy stays the same. Matt stays the same. Yeah, Angela's changes. Chuck changes.
Yeah, I think they're the only two who have that. Yeah.
Solomon changes.
Which is fair, because, like, they don't really change much about themselves throughout the whole thing.
I agree. But I think Isabel,
her character is definitely interesting.
It's so important. Her character in and of itself is not all that interesting. I feel like her relationship with Ash is what makes it interesting.
But that's the thing, right? They actually legitimately talked about that in the comic as a meta. Her character is only interesting through other people. She literally works through other gods, and that was a whole conversation within
Chuck
one of the
issues. Chuck calls
her
out on that, I think. Isn't it Chuck who says it?
It might be, yeah.
And it is, like, that classic idea of, like, so she's like the cleric, the god binder, who basically makes deals. So, like, her whole thing is that, like, she doesn't do anything. She just makes a deal with someone who does it for her. And therefore, she's kind of a fixed point, whereas the others can change a bit. But I think what's fascinating about Isabel is that, like, she clearly does not like Ash. Possibly, I mean, even so far as hates Ash for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, she's definitely, like,
she has a grudge, it seems, from their teen years.
Yes.
After that, she just doesn't, they don't clash, like, personality-wise, even though for the most of the comic, they're together.
Yeah.
Like, initially they split apart when the party splits, but then for the rest of it, they're always in a party that's together.
Yeah.
Even if they split up. Yeah, it's really, I do like that relationship, but from Ash's side.
Yeah. I mean, it's and interesting. Then Isabel was a little like, she even says it herself that she was a bit homophobic.
Yeah.
I guess homophobic, but also maybe a little transphobic towards Ash as well. And
but that's kind of the terminology they use, because yeah. Once again, they said they didn't have the words for it.
Yes. And she does show growth there, I think, in some ways. Like, she's willing to let... So it, when they were 16, she got really mad at Ash for stealing Simorna from her and called Ash a lot of names about that. And mm-hmm. then...
Which is ironic, because...
She presides in their wedding.
She does.
Yes.
But it's also ironic because Izzy actually came between the relationship that Saul and Ash had.
Yes, because in the real world, she was Saul's girlfriend.
His new girlfriend.
Yep.
So they broke up fairly quickly after entering this game.
Yeah.
But still, like, she was the initiator of that kind of situation, which is ironic that she's kept a grudge for, like, 20-plus years for Ash stealing her boyfriend.
Yeah.
And breaking that relationship. Yeah, I don't know. I honestly thought I would like Izzy.
Yeah.
And then a couple of issues in...
Well, I don't know that she's, like... I don't know that she's likable. Like, it's okay for a character to be... Like, I like her as a character. I don't like her as a human being, I guess. Like, she's not... Mm-hmm. She does some really awful things. She doesn't think things through. And some of the things that she does have really major consequences.
Yeah, and she's the one who is always like, quote unquote, the moral guide. Yeah. Whereas she causes so much problems.
Yeah. I like her relationship with Ash and that tension between them, to me, like, drives a lot of the... I feel like it drives a lot of the story. I mean, Chuck drives a lot of it too, but I don't know, because I see your point about, like, this is, I feel like this has been one of the hardest things for us to talk about.
Because there's so much.
There's so much to it, and there's so yeah. much that goes unsaid or is by implication of something that happened in the game 20 years ago. So we don't know too much about what actually happened mm-hmm. when they were 16. We get glimpses, but we don't know the details. And so, yeah, a lot of this is just by implication.
Which I think is what makes this such an interesting comic, because even though there are, like, plot holes and stuff in it, they're all so deliberately made
yeah.
that it's actually an amazing exercise in writing.
Yeah.
I really like this comic.
This comic is one of my favorites. I mean... Karen Gillan has written a lot of my favorites, Wicked plus the Divine, and the Divine, whatever it's called. It's another great one. The Young Avengers run that he did was also excellent. So, like, it's just so good. And it's doing something interesting. And mm-hmm.
Yeah,
go ahead.
What I truly got out of it is almost like a mini history of when it was a players versus DM story and how it grew into something that is communal and everyone wants to play together and yeah. everyone wants to have, like, a good story.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we get in the end with Saul saying that everything was for Ash, but also for his friends all around, when everyone kind of gets a decent ending in their yep. real life as well, right?
Yeah. Except Izzy.
Izzy. But once again, is that, like, reflection of how the game has changed throughout the years? And by the game, I mean most RPGs and how we see them in today's day.
Yep.
I really liked it. Thank you for introducing this to
yes.
me.
Yes, yeah. Highly recommend. So, like, I feel like we've talked about this a lot. We didn't quite do it justice. I don't know.
Oh,
I feel
absolutely
like there's
not.
So much here. There's so much depth. And let's be clear, it's gorgeous. This is an absolutely stunning comic. And
it's
even
beautiful.
If you don't like the story, like, it's beautiful. it's got this like painterly style, and it's just, there's so much emotion, mm-hmm. and I don't know, just
the colors stunning. Are so cool.
Yes, it's like a watercolor almost. Every mm-hmm. and every panel is just like a work of art. So yeah. Highly recommend checking this out, especially I think if you've someone who plays Dungeons and Dragons or other RPGs, this will make you think a lot.
Little nods to the games. It's really fun.
Yeah, and you'll enjoy this. Thank you so much for tuning in. I just want to mention a few of our socials. So we have our Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest handle is @inmedialez. Our subreddit is r/inmedialez. Our website is inmedialez.com. You can email us at inmedialez@gmail.com. If you have any questions or comments and you're willing, we'd be happy to give you a shout out, read them on air. Thank you so much to everyone. And please remember to rate, like, and subscribe and whatever, all that stuff that people tell you to do.
Yeah, we would appreciate it. Also, once you do read the comic, which you should have, by the way.
Yes.
But once you do, if you didn't, come back and listen to this episode again and you'll understand everything we were talking about.
Yes, we are 100% coherent all the time, always. And also write us an email telling us about how much you loved it.
Yeah. Analyze the writing to us.
Yes. Tell
five
us.
5 to 10 pages.
Yep. Double space, Times New Roman, 12, yeah. 1-inch margins, no cheating.
Please no plagiarism. You can get expelled for that.
Yeah, we will be checking.
It's very easy to check, guys. You just Google a sentence or two and it comes out.
Yeah. So thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, we'll see you in the next one.
Bye.